I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You've probably heard of this book, and I hope you have a chance to read it. The Unwinding and Inner History of the New America. George Packer is our guest this hour, author of the book, which is really the story of the last 30 or 40 years in the United States of America. And it's told through stories of memorable characters, the entrepreneurial son of a failed tobacco farmer, the black daughter of a heroin addict, a young man who really believes early on in Joe Biden and believes that he will one day be president, the billionaire founder of PayPal, and there are stories of public figures, not entirely flattering, Oprah Winfrey, Sam Walton of Walmart, Newt Gingrich, Colin Powell, Jay-Z, and others. George is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He's covered the Iraq War for the magazine. He's also the author of The Village of Waiting, about his experience in Africa, Blood of the Liberals, a three-generational nonfiction history of his family and American liberalism in the 20th century, which won the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award. He's written a couple of novels. He served in the Peace Corps in West Africa, and he has taught writing at Harvard, Bennington, and Columbia, and we're delighted to have him with us this hour. It's really a haunting book, and it's one of those books that you read something and you have another image of somebody and you go, no, say it ain't so, George, say it ain't so. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and I think that's about all the ways that you can get a hold of us. George, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
I don't know if it's the way you write or the people you found. It's probably a combination of both, but there's something about all of these stories, and other people have said this, that these people really stay with you. They speak for a huge segment of America, and they speak for a long period of time because you cover them over a long period of time, and they're haunting. They're haunting stories, aren't they?
Well, thank you. That's a compliment. I chose them partly for representativeness, and partly for the energy and humor and depth that they brought as individuals to the telling of their own story. I mean, for it to work, they had to be able to talk to me and to be willing to talk to me at great length, to let me spend a lot of time with them, hang out, travel around with them, stay at their house in some cases. But they also had to have lived lives that moved to the pulse of our recent American history, and that were swept along with some of the big currents and themes of that history. So, for example, Tammy Thomas, who you mentioned at the top as the daughter of a heroin addict, grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, and she therefore is the daughter of a classic Rust Belt city that was built on steel, and when steel died, Youngstown died. And Tammy's adult life was spent in the ruins of that death, and she had to figure out how to make her own way and how to raise three children on her own. So that gave me a window into the Rust Belt, which is, you know, the deindustrialization is one of the great stories of the past generation, one of the Central American realities. Dean Price, the son of the tobacco farmer in North Carolina, in rural North Carolina, gave me a different region. He gave me the rural South, the part of the rural South that was built on textiles and tobacco, which also faded somewhat after steel left Youngstown. And he also is he's a extraordinary individual with just an indelible voice. He describes his own life in sort of spiritual questing terms, but also very much materially. And that combination of faith and seeking one's fortune is a uniquely American combination that often goes together. And that's the story of Dean Price going from being the owner of a chain of truck stops in North Carolina and Virginia to seeing that business fail and remaking himself as an entrepreneur of biodiesel, spreading the good news of alternative energy, like some Johnny Appleseed around the North Carolina countryside.
And right.
So just two examples of why I chose these individuals and maybe why they chose me.
Yeah. Let's spend some time, because I think many of us can identify when we're young, 19 years old, we're in school, we find this political idealism. It usually centers on somebody we think is going to save the country and save the world, and we start working for that person and going door to door. And this is such a hard story to read and such a hard story, I'm sure, to write, because we want to hold on to that idealism. I found Jeff, how do you pronounce his last
name? Connaughton.
Connaughton's story to be just absolutely gripping, because maybe I identified with it. And he becomes obsessed with Joe Biden and thinks Joe Biden is really going to be a savior in some ways, huh?
He comes from Alabama, Jeff Connaughton, and all the stories begin around the late 70s, and that really is the beginning point of the book. So it's a whole generation of history from that moment until the present.
Mm-hmm.
And he invites Joe Biden down to Tuscaloosa to give a speech, and at that point Biden is a relatively unknown, very young senator from Delaware, and Biden's speech is dazzling. And Connaughton gets it in his head that this young senator is the next Kennedy. And the Kennedys were already myths in Connaughton's mind. And so he tells Biden, if you ever run for president, I'm going to be there with you. And he tells himself that Biden is going to be his vehicle to the summit of American life, to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a combination of soaring youthful idealism and very, you know, hard-driving youthful ambition.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you shatter a lot of illusions that we have about people. Joe Biden maybe isn't the happy, I'm really in touch with you kind of person that we see or that he has created for himself. He kind of uses Jeff, and he's not very nice to Jeff.
Yeah, he comes across in Jeff's story as a rather bullying boss who has a few intimates, but beyond that doesn't particularly care about the people working for him and doesn't nurture their careers and doesn't advance them. He won't make one simple phone call that would have made an enormous difference to Jeff Connaughton when he was being considered for a White House job during the Clinton years. So there's something very transactional about this relationship, and of course about Washington. It's all about power. And
mm-hmm.
So Jeff Connaughton's story is one young man's education in the ways of Washington power. And what Connaughton discovers, and this is not true of Biden is very wary of raising money and doesn't like it and doesn't do it very much, and in some ways punishes Connaughton for being a fundraiser. You know, he's both incorruptible and ungrateful, and Connaughton suffers for having raised a lot of money for Biden, which is a very strange position to find yourself in. Connaughton ends up as a lobbyist and finds more fulfillment in the private sector in Washington than he found working on Capitol Hill or in the Clinton White House, and makes a lot of money with a bipartisan lobbying firm called Quinn Gillespie during the real boom years of the 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s. So his story is partly a story of how during this 30 or 35 year history, big money, organized money, corporate money in the form of campaign contributions and in the form of lobbyists came to take over Washington, and
right.
Both parties.
Mm-hmm.
That is the key to Connaughton's story. And then Connaughton himself has a kind of a reckoning moment in 2008, which is really the watershed of the book and the year toward which all the characters' lives are moving. The financial crisis, the beginning of the Great Recession, the election of Barack Obama. Connaughton loses a lot of the money that he made as a lobbyist in the financial crisis, and then has the opportunity to get back into government when Biden becomes vice president and his seat is taken by a man named Ted Kaufman, who is very close with Connaughton. Kaufman brings Connaughton back to the Senate as his chief of staff, and together they make it their mission to try to enact really tough Wall Street regulation. And for 2 years, they do everything you're not supposed to do in Washington, offend every powerful person, and don't quite get there. And in the end, Connaughton leaves sort of permanently disillusioned with the nation's capital and burns all his bridges, which is a very unusual thing to do, by telling his story.
At least he has his dog, but his dog is sick.
She's well now.
He saved
her from her street life, and she's now a thriving companion.
Yeah, and is the book that he wrote, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, is that book out? I just don't know.
It is out.
It came
out last year, and it's a very stinging and candid, just brutally candid story of both Connaughton's life in Washington and of the way in which Wall Street dominated Capitol Hill, even in the months after the financial crisis when it needed taxpayer money. There was still enough lobbying going on to water down the Dodd-Frank bill, and in Connaughton's eyes, to water it down almost fatally.
Mm. There are, though, and I thought maybe you did this purposely, that you had to have a ray of hope there, and there are some rays of hope, but lo and behold, Elizabeth Warren is in your book.
She is. There are 10 portraits of public figures that are threaded through the narratives of these obscure Americans. And I chose them, too, partly for their representativeness. Mm-hmm. I wanted someone from the world of politics. And Newt Gingrich begins the book, or he's very early on in the book, because I think more than any single figure, he shaped the toxic political atmosphere that has become normal life in Washington. Sam Walton is there as the king of, you know, the small town boy who becomes an emperor of a giant retail multinational that is sort of the new economy that has replaced the old manufacturing economy. It's a retail economy with cheap goods, low prices, and low wages. Jay-Z is there as a figure from the entertainment world who sort of represents a one view of naked capitalism, a very talented kid from the projects who claws his way up to the top by any means he can and sort of glorifies success at all costs. And in fact, the more ruthless your ascent, the more you're admired by your fans. And then you mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and she is sort of a late figure in the book who I think speaks more the language of populism and an old-fashioned populism.
Right.
In fact, I compare her to Wisconsin's Robert La Follette.
Mm-hmm.
She comes from the prairie. She grew up in Oklahoma, and she speaks to people on Capitol Hill and to the banks and to the president without fear and without euphemism, and it's so rare in Washington that when she kind of walks onto the stage toward the end of the book, it's stunning to hear someone from the elite world speaking so truthfully and fiercely.
Well, why is that, George? Why is it that voice is so rare now, and that it's the world seems to be dominated, politics and big money and all of that, by, you know, this set of rules, who's going to walk across the room to say something to somebody else? You know, what? There's a lack of genuineness. There's a lack of, we're all in this together, my brother's keeper, you know, we all want the best for everybody. Why? Why is she a rarity?
I think if people at the top of society were to speak honestly, it would be intolerable. It would be to pull the curtain back on an arrangement that is absolutely elementally unfair. I mean, that's, if you get to the bottom of the story that this book tells over the past generation, it's of a society that has ripped up its old social contract and allowed a much more, you know, dog-eat-dog, brutal economics and society to take over. And it has favored some people, including some very good and talented people. But it has also left many, many people behind and struggling and even sinking to the bottom, who might once have been able to live secure, modest, working or middle-class lives. And if you were to tell that story without euphemisms, you know, without prettifying it. It's a painful and it's a story of real injustice. So no wonder we don't get much candor from people in power in Washington, Wall Street, and other centers of power.
George Packer is our guest. I hope some of you listening have had a chance to read his book, because I know you'll want to comment on it. The book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, a really substantial work of nonfiction done, as you heard him say, he lived with many of these people he followed and in some cases stayed in their homes and followed them for a long period of time. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Would you agree with what he just said, that we have ripped up our old political contract, that it is a fairly brutal society that we're living in now, kind of dog-eat-dog, and something substantial has changed in America over the past 30, 40 years. You see rays of hope anywhere. We welcome your phone calls and your thoughts, and we'll take them in a minute. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. George Packer is our guest this hour. His book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And let's go to phone calls for him. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
I'm riding my bike, so sorry about any background noise.
Good for you.
And to your guest, I'd just like to say, as a fellow returned Peace Corps volunteer, thank you for your service.
Same to you.
My question is as follows. It seems to me like what you've written about is something that a whole lot of people probably on a gut level can relate to. In other words, what seems to me is as you hear people talk politics or the economy or whatever, if you're on the left, you've got, you know, concerns and grievances, but you're mad. And if you're on the right, you've got concerns and grievances, but you're mad. And everybody seems to be really mad about politics and really mad about corporate America. I mean, my own opinion is that what really sparked the Tea Party was, I mean, sure, they've got a gripe, you know, they don't like Obama, obviously, but I think this whole business that after all they'd done to us, meaning all the people on the who aren't in the command control center, what those folks had done to all of us was so outrageous, and then we bail them out? How dare they? And, you know, whether you
how's
the truck going by?
Oh, Scott, be careful.
No, I'm on the walk. It's okay.
All right.
He's on the road next to me. Anyhow, yeah, this could be quite a phone call.
I know.
Anyhow, I'm rambling along here, time here, but do you see any kind of a vein of that where maybe there's, you know, because certainly the information is out there and the media is, I mean, not the media, but the Internet is all over every rumor, true or not. Is there hope?
Is there hope? Well, the first thing I have to say is this is not a polemical book, and it is not a policy book. It's not really, strictly speaking, even a political book, although there's lots and lots of political feelings and statements and acts in it. It's a book about people and about their lives, and what I really wanted to do was not weigh in on, you know, God forbid, one side or the other of the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, you know, the Fox News, MSNBC debates that are part of, in some ways, the unwinding itself. You know, the fact that our news has turned into a cacophony of uninformed opinion, both on cable news and on the Internet. Instead, I wanted to paint a picture that would show people where we are and who we are and how we became this way, and to try to give them a view of ourselves that rises above the politics of the day or the arguments and the nastiness of the day. So it isn't a book that it leads you or leaves you with a few prescriptions that you can then bat around and argue with. And some people have said that was a weakness in the book, but it was never my intent to do that. It would have been a different kind of book.
Mm.
I think if it leaves you with hope, it's in the way the people portrayed live their lives and in the
right.
the things they find to do when all seems lost to keep trying to lift themselves and their communities up.
Mm.
They're people who, Tammy Thomas Dean.
Tammy, I was thinking of her, right.
Yeah, she becomes a community organizer after losing her assembly line job at an auto parts factory. And being a community organizer, it may not lead to the turnaround of Youngstown, but it gives her this passionate way of trying to right some of the wrongs in her own hometown and to give people around her a voice that they didn't have. Dean Price goes bankrupt multiple times, and his partnership dissolves, and he loses everything, and he keeps coming back because he's so wedded to the vision that he's going to get rich and he's going to sort of resurrect the troubled countryside around him with canola oil, with waste
right,
restaurant oil
right.
turned into biodiesel. He's
yeah.
a dreamer, and America's always depended on its dreamers. So these are the reasons for hope, not necessarily because there's some macro political or macroeconomic change coming down the road.
And I found it really interesting. Tammy's story is just so absorbing, the depth of the horrors that she had to live through, and her mother and the killings and the drugs and nobody raising her. And I mean, it's just an incredible story. And when you talk about hope, you feel that she'll make it in some way. When you talk about her becoming a community organizer after all these years in the factory and hard work, but raising her kids and getting them to school, and there's something about her story, the least likely perhaps of all of these people, that makes you think, by golly, she's led a worthy life, and you can do it somehow, but you got to go to the depths of who you are to do it.
Yes, and that's very, you know, very well put. And she was raised by her great-grandmother, who cleaned the homes of the wealthy white steel barons around Youngstown. And Tammy saw her working hard and got a work ethic from her great-grandmother and vowed, even after she got pregnant at 15 and broke her granny's heart, vowed that she would make something of herself and that she would not go the way of so many of the girls she saw around her, and, you know, who were living in the projects. And she made good on that vow, even though, you know, there were many moments of darkness when she lost her longtime job, most of her pension, and then her buyout money due to an ill-advised investment, which was true of a lot of Americans a few years ago, looking for a quick way to get a little cushion under them. She said to me many times, I just did what I was supposed to do, as if it was the most obvious, normal thing in the world. And yet, it turns out it's one of the rarest things in the world. And it's a kind of heroic thing
yes,
to be able
yes.
to say. And so she represents herself, but she also represents people who have made mistakes but have also been faithful to their own deal with themselves and with the world around them in a way that America may not have been faithful to them. She still believes in the American dream, whether or not it still believes in her.
Mm. Thank you, Scott. Always great to hear from you, and I'll feel better now that you're safe on that bike trail. Let's go to Marge in Mequon. Hi, Marge.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Marge, you?
I'm just fine.
Good.
And I certainly appreciate your guest, especially as we're approaching the 4th of July. But my question is, I don't understand why it happened. I lived out of the country for nearly 10 years, and when I came back in 2011, I was shocked, to say the least. It was quite an ordeal for me. But I'm kind of wondering about why all this disintegration happened.
Where did you live, Marge?
I lived in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Singapore and Japan.
Hmm. George?
So the book begins in the late 70s because I think a lot of this goes back to that time. You know, we forget the 70s because it was sort of a nondescript and sort of dismal time. Styles were bad. Music was bad. But think about the things that were happening around the late 70s. Deindustrialization and the end of union factory jobs began around that time in Youngstown with the steel mills. In Milwaukee, probably, you know, with some of the engine makers.
Right.
Yeah.
At the same time, the information age begins then for you know, large numbers of Americans with the personal computer. And that's supposed to be the next stage of economic growth, but its promise really never is felt among the broad majority of people, really only in isolated areas and among a handful of tech moguls. It changes everyone's lifestyle. It doesn't raise their standard of living.
Mm.
And finally, you have in Washington both the rise of lobbying and big organized money as a powerful force, and also the rise of the right as a very powerful ideology whose purpose was to either undermine or take over the institutions of government that the right thought were in the hands of ideological leftists. And that created this politics of vitriol and politics of institution breaking. I mean, when Newt Gingrich came to Congress in 78, his goal wasn't to build it up. It was to tear it down and build up his own and his party's power in the rubble of Congress. So one by one, you know, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's the media, schools, government, corporations, you have all these mainstays of middle-class life from the post-war period beginning to erode. And by 2008, they were toppling from General Motors to Wall Street to commercial banks and the economy itself.
To schools, public schools.
And public schools absolutely are a big part of that story.
Yeah.
And 78 was also the year, I should add.
I was even shocked when I came back, and I thought, carry and conceal. I couldn't believe we'd gotten into that position. But I like your point about that. It happened across a number of institutions that started to break apart, and that really eroded the middle class. It wasn't just one. It was a whole cross-section of things.
And that's why I wanted to paint this broad picture of the country and go to different regions and look at different individuals so that I could have a bigger canvas and make the connections between different institutions and the lives of the characters who are on sort of the receiving end of these changes. Schools, you know, the tax revolt of 78, the year I graduated from high school in California, began the defunding of public education in my home state and led to that the same in other states. So it's and I think you have to add to this, some of these changes happen because of global competition and, you know, America being eclipsed as the sole economic power, and they were inevitable changes. But I think that our elites who were leading these institutions began to act in more short-sighted and self-interested ways because they could, because the social norms changed with these other changes, and taboos fell, and it became much more everyone for himself than it had been in the previous period.
Thanks so much, Marge, for the call. Let's spend a little bit of time on Newt Gingrich, because your chapter on him is very interesting, and in a way he encapsulates things kind of going haywire and this mushy morality, et cetera. I didn't know that his father gave up the naming rights to Newt to keep from paying child support.
Yeah, he was actually named after, his first name was after his biological father, but that marriage ended pretty much, you know, the night after Newt was conceived.
Oh.
And his father then gave him up for adoption in order not to have to pay child support. And as his mother later said, can you imagine such a thing being sold by your own father?
Right.
Newt Gingrich had a terrible childhood. The man who adopted him, his stepfather, was a army officer who really didn't have a whole lot of respect for his adopted son. And so Newt lived in a fantasy world of dinosaurs and war movies and nature and animals, and in many ways was this incredibly curious and mature boy but he also had a complex of grandiosity that did not stand him in very good stead when he became a man, and in some ways he was more of a boy as a man than he ever was as a boy. And it led him to a vision of himself as the savior of American civilization. He wrote that. He committed himself to that, but it really meant he would do it by tearing down existing institutions, polarizing the debate, developing a language for himself and his fellow Republicans that was demonizing. It didn't just argue, it demonized the opponent into an enemy. And I use that language. The technique of these portraits of public figures is to use their own language in telling their story in a way that they might not be comfortable with, but it comes from them, not from me. It shows things about them that they don't like to display about themselves, but in their own jargon, in the way Newt Gingrich poisoned political language, in the way Sam Walton created a kind of folksy myth about himself while building this empire.
Right. And it's hard to have somebody be this savior of civilization when you're living kind of an unexamined personal life. At least I've always thought that about him, that these stories are true, that his wife had cancer and he's asking for a divorce and she's got cancer, and he's fooling around with wife number three while he's married to wife number two. All of that just doesn't sit very well.
It's not a pretty picture of the man.
No.
He's a very unpleasant seeming person. There's no redeeming the, you know, the Newt Gingrich, the human being, in at least not as he's lived his life thus far, which is one reason why Bill Clinton couldn't have asked for a better rival. Clinton had his own problems in his personal life, but he was a likable person.
Right.
And Gingrich was, you know, envious of him, not least because Clinton got the girl. And Gingrich, you know, didn't get the girls that Clinton got. You can imagine them being, you know, hating each other in college if they had known each other. And yet they're both from these broken, lower middle class, small town families growing up at the same time. Their lives are weirdly parallel.
George Packer is our guest. We'll welcome more phone calls. He's the author of a highly acclaimed book. It's going to win a lot of awards, I think, this year because of the careful eye that he has for people from all kinds of different backgrounds. You can tell, knew them very well, stayed with them, and covered them for a number of years. To look, you know, essentially at why things have gone haywire in terms of a social contract, in terms of people's political dreams and idealism, and what's happened to people financially. The book is The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. Our number is 800-486-8655. George Packer is our guest, The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. And we'll be back to your phone calls. They're coming in pretty rapidly. But I wanted to talk a little bit, because I've always wondered about her, and I think it's interesting you included Oprah Winfrey in the book. What's Oprah's story? How did she become this huge, omnipresent magazine, television, radio, cable, etc., figure in America, George?
You know, talent, luck, and huge ambition. She came from nowhere, from the middle of rural Mississippi, born in the 1950s, raised first by her grandparents and then by her mother in Milwaukee for a few years, and that didn't go very well, and Oprah kind of became a wild child in the 60s, and then was sent to her a man she thought was her father, but turned out not to be. And in fact, her father's identity still is mysterious. But this man was a Christian with a strong work ethic, lived in Nashville. And so Oprah, you know, had this tumultuous childhood and youth, and then began to work for local TV in Nashville, in Baltimore, and then got her big break in Chicago. And she's in my book because, first of all, it's an incredible story of coming from nothing to being just a, a queen, a kind of goddess of TV. But also because the message that she puts out day in, day out on TV and that her millions of devoted followers hear is, I think, a particularly American message, which is that if you are right with the world, if your soul is right, if you think the right thoughts, if you think positively, then there's no limit to what you can do, and you can even become Oprah Winfrey. And to me, it's a bit of a sinister message because it tells her viewers, if you can't make it, then there's something wrong with you. You must, your spirit is amiss. You're not aligned with the purposes of the universe. She has this, you know, New Age talk, but it really is, there's nothing new about it. It goes back to an old American idea of self-reliance and of believing that if, you know, that your own mind and your own will are enough to conquer reality.
Right.
And in so many cases, it's not true. And it the last sentence of that, of the Oprah chapter of the book, says that she, you know, because there was no random suffering in life, in other words, all suffering was there for a reason, she left her viewers with no excuse. And it's a kind of cruel situation where she is soaring into the celebrity stratosphere, which is an elite place par excellence, where they are friends with each other, they socialize with each other, they eat at each other's restaurants, and she's sort of saying, you can do it too, but in fact, you know, her viewers are, their lives are not happening. They're not happening the same way. And in fact, over these years, many of them are finding their financial situations getting more and more dire.
Yeah. Well, I also, and you include some of this in your book, that also during this time period, and Oprah is a case in point, we had all these books that came. I've been in this business for years and years, but I remember interviewing, who is that guy who said, you know, you can walk on coals, and if you can do that, you know, or if you imagine yourself to be a person with great wealth and think about that, you deserve that as a human being, and just, you know, these easy paths to becoming some big thing in life. There was a lot of that over the last 30 years, wasn't there, George?
I think it comes up, especially at times of great inequality, where the normal paths of upward mobility seem cut off. And instead, we are treated daily to the spectacle of amazing success, whether it's Silicon Valley style or rap music style or TV star style. And so there's a magical thinking that sets in where you know, to get out of this rut that seems so stubborn, you have to think your way to the highest level. There is no sort of normal, slow, incremental progression. And so I think it happens at times like this where there's economic constraint and stagnation.
Interesting. Let's go to Roger in Beaver Dam. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I was wondering if the author has done anything on Warren Buffett. He strikes me as a modern-day robber baron who has cultivated this persona of a kindly old uncle who's just a good investor. And it seems to me, as I learn more about his empire, seem to be more sinister aspects to it than kindly aspects to it.
You know the quote, behind every great fortune, there's a great crime. I think if you dig into almost any of our billionaires, you will find something that doesn't look right. And yet, Warren Buffett is one of those rare titans of finance who actually seems to believe in the social contract. And to complain that his taxes aren't high enough and that his fellow billionaires are too selfish. He got into a very public fight with, you know, people like Steven Schwarzman of Blackstone, a Wall Street private equity firm, saying that, you know, the idea of paying 15% on your hedge fund gains is criminal. It's repellent. So I don't know. I'm hesitant to put too much blame on Warren Buffett for whatever his financial sins may be, because he's a rare, you know, we've lost this idea that the people at the top have some responsibility.
Right.
That they have a custodial relation to the institutions that have benefited them so much. And instead, you know, the model mogul is Mark Zuckerberg, who, you know, who whatever the goodness of his philanthropy, you know, is his motto, and Facebook's is move fast and break things. They're not about making sure that newspapers can still survive in the information age. They're about, you know, a kind of survival of the fittest that, you know, sees many newspapers, you know, drowning.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take on Walmart for a minute, because why not? You can do that with Walmart, and it just knocks me out every time I read about them and the Walton family, the amount of money, how they really have fundamentally changed the way rural America operates and small stores and where money is and how much money they accumulated. And then, I didn't know this, They are not philanthropists. They don't give money to charities. They give $1,000 to local, what, high school in terms of a scholarship. Was a drop in the bucket when you think about the dough they have.
I think that was truer when Sam Walton was alive and at the helm, and he was a wonderfully folksy face for this juggernaut. And as long as he was alive, Walmart was very rarely criticized. It was seen as a great success story out of Bentonville, Arkansas. But I think once he died, the media began to look into Walmart's, you know, labor practices and the way it drove all these Main Street businesses out of business, and the way it drove manufacturing overseas and began to depend on China. And but they also, you know, developed a foundation in order to be able to say that they were giving away money. So I think that that was more Walton's era than it is today. But, you know, there is this family in the unwinding, the Hartzell family in Tampa. We haven't talked about Tampa, but it's a big part of the book because it's where the housing boom is at its craziest and hottest, and the housing bust is at its most devastating. The Hartzells are, you know, down at the bottom of the economic ladder. They work, but they're extremely poor, and Walmart is their world. They work there. The father has, until he loses it, like an $8.50 an hour job stocking produce, whittled down to 20 hours a week, and never sure when those hours are going to be. So he's completely at the mercy of the store and can't possibly raise his family, his two kids, on that kind of money. So they have to shop at Walmart because the prices are unbeatable. And Walmart is like the company store that owns them, and you can never get out from under its shadow. And that's what it's done in so many small towns and rural areas. It's driven out the old drugstore, shoe store, gas station, and it's become, you know, this master of people's lives in the heartland. And that's also true in Dean Price's story as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger, for your call about Warren Buffett. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
I was listening to public TV a while back talking about mental health and some of the war veterans coming back with symptoms like sociopaths. And then after listening to that show, the thing that went to my mind is how many of these CEOs running these big corporations might be sociopaths? I mean, where they get these big profits for themselves and throwing all these people out to work. I mean, I don't see how they could do that unless if they are a sociopath.
That's a very interesting analogy. You know, the chapter on Jay-Z in The Unwinding is called Just Business, which is a kind of mob quote. It's what mobsters say when they're about to kill each other. It's just business. And it's something Jay-Z has repeated at certain moments. I was talking to someone out in Silicon Valley who said to me, to say something is just business says you're a sociopath. He used exactly the same word as the caller. In other words, if there are no other values, you know, whether it's employees, consumers, the country, the environment, if it's just business, and that is the only thing a CEO has to be loyal to, shareholder value, which is a very short-term way of thinking about a company's health, and as we've seen over and over in the last few years, then there is something sort of pathological about it, and it's not a foundation for a healthy economy. It's a foundation for CEO pay to go up 15% a year, as it's been doing.
Thank you very much, David, for the call. Yeah, I keep asking every time we do shows, and it seems like we do so many, of how people aren't making it, this huge gap between those who have a lot and how much money all these people have. And you just think, wait a second, just on some fundamental level, something is off, because some people have so much money that you couldn't begin to know what to do with all of that, George, in your life. And other people are making $8.50 an hour, and they can't make it even if they shop at Walmart. You know, there's something off.
And some of the people who haven't loved my book have said that it doesn't understand economics. It doesn't have a political and economic theory to explain all this. And if it did, it wouldn't be able to find these, you know, it wouldn't have a moral stance. It would have to admit that this is all in the, you know, about global changes in technology and in the way people work. You know, there is some truth to that. But again, is it absolutely necessary that, you know, we have an economic arrangement where CEOs make an average of $15.1 million as was true last year, in good times and bad, while they can squeeze their workers to the point where they cannot raise a family and depend on public assistance? Is that really the best, even from a practical point of view,
yes,
from a sort of efficiency point of view, is that the best state of affairs, leaving aside whether it's a moral arrangement?
Mm-hmm.
And I think more and more Americans are asking these questions and are saying, is this really the best we can do?
Mm-hmm.
And if it isn't, then it doesn't really matter if, you know, you can point to macroeconomic forces that are causing it. You still have to say, we have to change. We cannot go on like this, because the social fabric is disintegrating. And I wanted to mention that there's a PBS show coming next week on Frontline next Tuesday about Milwaukee.
Yes.
Called Two American Families.
Mm-hmm.
And the producers followed a black and a white family in Milwaukee over the last 20 years. And the story is very similar to what we've been talking about and what The Unwinding is about. And it shows you even families that did most things right couldn't make it. So you just can't fall back on the easy game of blaming people for their own mistakes. It is in the very nature of our system today that people won't make it no matter how hard they work and how good they are. And that's just not a system most Americans want to live in.
Well, we're on the same page, because we're doing a show on Monday on that PBS show that you just talked about. It's
wonderful.
Monday at, when, around to 10 o'clock? We're not on in the morning anymore. We just switched times. I'm all mixed up. 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday. Well, I don't know who could not like your book, because even if you... I mean, who could not like it? Because it's just so well written. It's just, it's good. Thank you, George,
thank you so much for
being with us.
It's my pleasure always.
Yeah, thanks. George Packer, our guest. His book is The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Very, very well written. Such a piece of substance. It covers such a long period of time, and he's with the people he writes about for a long time. Lives with them in some instances. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, also author of Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. He's written a play. He's done two novels, and we thank him for his time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this show. And stay tuned for great conversations ahead.